It's Monday, December 25th, 2017, Masoret. All right, so we're taking up what I would regard as, legitimately or arguably one of the most dramatic scenes in the entire Torah. As I mentioned, I think in this past week's Dvar Torah, that in general, the Torah is not written in an ordinary literary style. When it tells, it deals with matters of great significance and emotional significance, but it just says it matter-of-factly. You can think of a lot of scenes, even the Akedah, we did the Akedah, there's nothing in there that hardly brings out the emotions. I mentioned this point, that there are many different places in the Torah where a novelist would have written it in a very dramatic way. However, I think that not that the story of Yosef and the brothers is written that way either. If anybody, there's been many novels written based on that. Obviously, they'd be written differently, but it really evokes a tremendous amount of emotion. So what I would say is probably the most dramatic, emotional scene in the Torah is the reunion. And that's in Parshas Vayigash, when Yosef decides that it's time to, quote, end the charade, unquote. Because what was going on was a charade. And I don't know how many people truly understand that he chose to keep himself hidden, to pretend he was a stranger. When he first encountered the brothers. And he was able to do that. He recognized them, they didn't recognize him. It's interesting because I think that statement has deeper connotations in terms of, that is, the brothers never really understood Yosef. Although that's not the pshat. I mean, the pshat is very simple. It's just telling you that that's a very significant fact. Had they recognized, everything hinges on that. Had they recognized Yosef, then that's it. All of his plans would not have been fulfilled. It would have been a different scenario. I know a lot of people have a difficulty. Like, how could they not recognize their brother? I don't think that. I think I take Rashi. Rashi explains it. He was 17. He mentions the fact that that he didn't have a beard. He said he was 17 and he looked like a kid. And that's what they remembered. They, however, were grown men and they had a beard. That is, they had their mature look. And once you've seen a person with his mature look, and also the additional benefit that Yosef had was that, you see, it's very different when you're expecting to see someone as opposed to when you're not. So if you're not looking, you don't expect to see somebody, even if that person is there, but that person doesn't look exactly, there's been some changes, you're not going to notice. So they were not expecting to see Yosef, and the ruler that they saw bore no resemblance to the kid that they remembered. That was 22 years before. So they didn't recognize him. The idea that that kid would be the ruler of Egypt was insanity, as far as they were concerned. And he recognized them. I'm only saying that on a deeper level, because the Torah is on many levels, they didn't recognize Yosef. They didn't understand Yosef. That becomes very clear in Parshas Vayechi. So then he initiates the charade. And that is, he speaks harshly with them, and then he locks them all up, and then he decides to not to release them, but keep one behind. I'd gone through all the different aspects of the story years ago, and there was a series, I did it one summer, and there's a series of four tapes on that. I took that up, going through the entire story of Yosef and his brothers, pretty much point by point, and analyzing it, I think I titled it A Family United, Reunited. I'm not sure what I titled it, something like that. And then I distributed it to a lot of people. They had no idea. They thought I'm talking... It depends what world you're living in. They thought I was talking about an actual family that had gone through some suffering and everything. And they had no idea I was talking about the family of Yaakov. It might be still... It probably should be available. I mean, then it was done the old way with tapes.
A Family in Crisis,
maybe? A Family in Crisis. That was the title. I thought it would be a good title because that's what I was depicting. That, you know, what had happened, the family had fallen apart. And then they became reunited. But when I distributed it to certain people, they thought I was talking about a contemporary family that was going through a crisis. All right, so we've analyzed what the motivations were behind the so-called charade. Yosef was doing it essentially with divine inspiration. We're not taking that up now. And but basically, as we know, his purpose was to put every member of the family into a circumstance in which he was forced to overcome that particular emotion which had been responsible for the error or the sin that he had committed. The brothers, and even Yaakov Avinu, even Yaakov did not escape. Because as we said, he was guilty too, because the excessive favoritism that he displayed to Yosef was a significant factor. We went through the whole thing, how Binyamin had become a substitute, and Yosef put him in a situation where he was forced to part with Binyamin. And then the final scene was Yehuda, where, knowing full well, and it's important to realize, or Ray Chan had pointed this out, that it wasn't just that Yehuda would, how far would he go to protect Binyamin / Yosef? Because Binyamin, as we said, was a substitute for Yosef, and that was essential for them to overcome their prior hatred to Yosef. But it wasn't just that, because if you take a look at the argument of Yehuda, his plea to Yosef, everything was based upon the fact that this would destroy his father. That is, he had seen that Yosef took an interest in the aged father, and it was really a plea for mercy to the father, because to not bring back Binyamin would cause him to die in a miserable way. But you see, so you see that was the essence of Yehuda's deed, his gesture, that he was prepared to give up his own freedom. But what's interesting to note is that if that's the case, well, what you're saying is, so take me instead of Binyamin and let Binyamin go back. Yeah, but then you could ask the question, but then what about the fact that you don't come back? Won't that cause your father to suffer in the same way? And the answer is no, because I'm not the favorite. And he is. So on another level, what Yosef saw was, because that was also part of the sin of the brothers, that it may have been wrong, it was wrong, for Yaakov to play favoritism, but it was wrong of the brothers not to be able to live with that, to accept the fact that he had a right to have a favorite, that he had a right to love one particular son more than the other. I know this is very hard for parents to accept, because they all feel guilty. They feel that they have an obligation to love their children equally. Now, I don't agree with that, because love is a different kind of a thing. Love is a very hard thing to control. And when it says you shall love your friend as yourself, it's not talking about the emotional kind of love, which is an impossibility. First of all, it extends to each and every fellow Jew. And many people, as we know, are not lovable. You can't force a person to love someone. It's like when your parents, you know, chided you that you have to love your brother or your sister or whatever. Yeah, but you hate them, at least then. So even when it comes to your parents, The Torah never said you have to love your father and mother. It has to honor your father and mother. That is, the Torah is mandating a form of behavior and consideration and respect. Act. Act as though you love them, but you don't have to love them in your heart. The only command, that's a different kind of love. It's not even appropriate. We have to love the Lord your God, but that's a different kind of love, as the Rambam explains. That's something we should strive for. Because that's, but you can't command me to love. Yes, you can. Because with God, God is the one to whom one should direct their love. One should love God. But in order to obtain that, you have to arrive at that understanding, which will automatically lead you to a love of God. However, not everybody in the world should be loved. In fact, we're commanded to hate certain people. And even good people, that really you might love them, but that's if you got to know them on a certain level. So that's not going to happen. So therefore, would it make sense to say that parents must love all their children equally? It wouldn't even make sense to say that parents must love their children. Because unfortunately, not all children are worthy of being loved. I mean, I know plenty of parents that have such sorrows. Whoever's fault it was and whatever. But they have such suffering from children. You know, today with all the crises. And they go off the path, off the derech, and get involved in drugs and so on and so forth. And, you know, they adopt very ugly types of characteristics, and they're really mean to their parents and disrespectful. So what kind of love? I know people say that, no matter what they do, I'm going to love them. But I think it means you're talking about a certain commitment. You have a certain commitment. It's your child. You brought the child into the world. You raised the child, and you feel a tremendous sense of responsibility. But it's very hard to love someone that's behaving in a very unlovable kind of a way. In fact, if the child today it's very common with intermarriage. I don't know what they did in the past. The child converts to Christianity, any religion, so the parent sits Shiva. It's not their child anymore. So therefore, in my opinion, there's nothing immoral on any level of a parent having, loving one child more, because that child is more lovable. As I say, however, practically speaking, it's not a good idea unless you can completely hide it, because that's a different story. Some people might be able to do that. Yaakov did not. And it will cause tremendous... At the same time that I'm saying this, I'm saying that it's probably the worst thing to give any indication that, you know, you get more satisfaction out of this child than that one because of the envy factor. Now, envy is probably the most painful emotion, and especially in that framework, when someone whose love you really desire and crave, and that love is given to somebody else. I mean, you see, that's by Leah. God saw that Leah was hated. Doesn't mean that Yaakov hated her, but since she wanted his love and she sensed that he loved Rachel more, which he did love Rachel more, says so in the Pasuk. So when you're in that situation, you perceive it, you experience it as hatred. So now we get back to the reunion. When Yosef saw that, that Yehuda was prepared to give up his freedom in exchange for Binyamin, and thereby he was accepting the fact that the absence of Binyamin would kill his father, but the absence of Yehuda would not kill his father. So Yosef decided that all his goals had been achieved, and now was the time to reconcile. So you get ready for the most dramatic moment you've ever seen. And of course, he didn't want to embarrass his brother. So he got everybody out of there. He didn't want anybody except the principals, him and his brothers. I don't even know, because Rashi says, I believe that Menashe, he always refers to Menashe, was the one who served as his interpreter. But I don't know if Menashe would have been present. That's a good question to discuss. Because, in my, the question would be, I mean, and this is a big question that I've always asked, how many people actually found out what really happened? Even Yaakov, we've discussed it, did Yaakov ever find out? But Yosef was very careful not to embarrass his brothers. So therefore, that required that nobody should be there and hear what Yosef was going to tell them. He was going to reveal the crime that they had committed. So I don't think he would even want Menashe to be there. Menashe and Ephraim, his own sons. Because why would they need to know? Why would they need to know that? These were his uncles. He wasn't going to discover his uncles. And I would say that he cleared everybody out. And it would be painful for them to be embarrassed in front of Yosef's children. Now, of course, this became a sensation in Egypt. The brothers of Yosef. Yosef was this great hero. And the idea that he's been it was a great, great story. Too bad they didn't have the kind of, I guess today we have fake news, the kind of coverage that we have today. Can you imagine a story like that? But the story was not that these brothers who had sold Yosef had now been reunited with him. He had to make up a story. Bear in mind that Yosef was always careful, never let on what his brothers had done to him. What his brothers had done to him. Even the ones who's the Yishmaelim or the Midianim, we'll take that up separately, who actually sold him. I don't think that they knew. Because they didn't know who these people were that when, you know, that took Yosef out of the pit and sold, who sold Yosef. They didn't know that they were his brothers. Of course, Yosef might have told them on the journey down to Egypt, but I don't think he did. And when he appealed to the butler, which we discussed last week, he didn't say that he was sold by his brothers. He says, Gunav Gunafti, I was stolen, meaning I was kidnapped. But by who? By kidnappers. So even at that point in time, he was very careful to keep that fact a secret. You have to recognize how important these things are. Certain things have to be kept a secret. So he gets rid of everybody. And we're in chapter 45. And then it says, Vayiten es kolo b'fchi. And then he let out with a tremendous cry. Yeah, the Torah records a number of times that Yosef cried. So he was a very emotional person. And you don't have to be emotional in a situation like this. Now he was able to do that. I guess he had to control his feelings all the time. You got to imagine that it's almost a superhuman act of self-control. Put yourself in that situation. You're now, everything they've done failed. You're now the ruler. Now they've come down. You forgive them. You want to reunite. You want to tell them. You want to tell them that it worked out great, that everything is fine. I'm the king of Egypt. And he had to maintain. But not only that, but you want to hug them. They're your brothers. For the last 22 years, you've been a stranger. I'm sure, look, he got married. He had friends and all that. But his own family. How many people could control the emotional desire to just reunite? You know who I really am? But he waited. He waited. How long did he wait from the time that he first saw them until he revealed? How much, what are we talking about here? Yeah, I think that the brothers came down in the second year of the famine. That's what he says. Kizesh Nasayim Harav Bekarabites. This is the second year of the famine in the land, and there's yet another 5 years. So then it was a matter of months, because I don't know exactly how much time elapsed between his taking Shimon and the brothers go back, and Yaakov is reluctant to send them back, and they finally run out of food, and then they return with Binyamin. So that's a matter of months. And throughout that time, Yosef keeps the secret to himself. So then he says, "Vayomi Yosef Elechav." Now he's got to tell them. I mean, how do you tell? How do you break the news? Yosef said to his brothers, "I am Yosef. Ha'od Avichai, I am Yosef. Is my father still alive? V'lo yachlu echav lanos oso." And the brothers could not answer him. Ki nivalu mipanav. Because they were nivalu, bahala. Like, it's a... Bahala is when a person is like completely shocked. Disoriented. Like you hear something and you can't talk. It just knocks you off your feet. But the question, of course, and everybody asks this question, is what did Yosef mean? Is my father still alive? Because he knew, he had to know that he was. Because this whole event, the second return, when the brothers return, the second time they come to Egypt, so everything that transpires takes place within a day and a night, and the overnight. That is that as soon as they come, they're brought to the house of Yosef, and everything is going great, and they prepare the gift, and they have this party, and all that business. And then he sends them on their way, you know, with gifts, and so on and so forth. And then... of course, he places the goblet in Binyamin's saddle or sack, whatever. And then he sends his guy after them, and he catches up with them, and he brings them back. And then, which is the next day, because they left the next morning. And then you have Yigash Yehuda, the approach of Yehuda takes place on that day. However, when they first came back and they had the meal with Yosef, so he asked, pointedly asked about your father. How's your father, the aged man? Is he still alive or whatever? Is he well? And they said, yes, he's well. So Yosef knew. So there was nothing that the brothers could have found out in the meantime that Yosef. What's changed? What's changed from yesterday? Yesterday Yosef knew that they were alive. Now it's the next day. We assume he's still alive, and if anything had happened, the brothers wouldn't know. So what does he mean when he says Ha'od Avichai? That is the question. The Torah Tamima, who brings down a Gemara, which is in Chagiga, Daf Dalet Amud Beis, and he says, Rabbi Elazar, ki mati lahai kra havi bachi. When Rabbi Elazar came to this pasuk, he cried. Amar, he says, Umato chacha shal basav adam, if the rebuke of flesh and blood, ksiv bava lo yachlu echav lano so, it says with regard to it that the brothers couldn't answer him, ki nivalo mipanav, because they were thunderstruck from before him. To chacha shal HaKadosh Baruch Hu, alachas kama v'kama. So then the rebuke of Hashem, how much more so? That's what he said. Of course, what's the question with his statement? What's difficult about his statement? He used to cry when he came to this pasuk. What's difficult is that if you read the pasuk, where's the tochacha? Where's the rebuke? Yosef simply said, we don't understand why he asked the question, but he didn't rebuke them. In fact, the entire... encounter, the reunion, Yosef doesn't say a harsh word. To the contrary, he's trying to assuage their feelings and trying to convince them that he has no intention of harming them or taking revenge. But certainly he didn't rebuke them. So where's the rebuke? Actually, Rabbi Chait explained this. And of course, the intent of the question was not, is my father physically alive? But in a sense, he was asking Avi, my father. That is to say, is he still alive as my father? Or put a different way, is he still my father? Well, what do you mean? If he's alive, then he's your father. Because he meant to say, this is, by the way, this is a long time ago, so I'm just trying to recreate this as best as I can, as best as I remember it. But essentially, he understood, and the brothers did not. The brothers refused to accept that. He understood the devastation of the loss that Yaakov suffered. Well, first of all, you see that Yosef was a great psychologist. There's tremendous insight into human psychology. And he knew about the closeness of the relationship. And while it didn't destroy Yosef, it came very, very close to destroying Yaakov. Yaakov refused to be comforted. Now that's a tough thing. Well, it's the toughest thing in the world when you lose a parent loses a child. It's the toughest thing in the world. So in the case of Yaakov, I believe when this happens, because I've spoken to parents. I know parents that have lost children. They have to make a decision. They have to make a decision. And the decision is, are we going to move on or not? That's crucial. And, you know, I know certain parents said, how are you doing? We decided we're going to move on. And that doesn't mean they're going to, ignore and forget about it. They can't, but they're not going to give up life. They're going to continue, recuperate, and go on with life. But there are people that can't do that. They can't accept it. Now, when Yaakov refused to be comforted, and he said, I'll go down to my grave mourning, that's a very serious thing. But where I changed that was that sometimes a person is able to get over it, but he sort of has to uproot that whole thing from his psyche. In other words, it's as though that person was never my child. And again, these are my own words. I'm just trying to reconstruct it. And you lose something. Because a part of your psyche is just ignored. It's removed. And you can't go back there. That is to say, that never happened. That person is not my child, never was my child. This whole thing never happened. Because the pain is too great. So he says that when the brothers came back, and it says this is in chapter 45, verse 26, Vayagidlo, they came back to Yaakov. They brought back the wagons and so forth. Now they had to tell all this to Yaakov. And they said, Yosef chai, Yosef is still alive. V'chihu Moshe b'chal eretz Mitzrayim. And he rules over all of Egypt. V'yafag libo. And his heart melted. Ki lo hamin lahem. He didn't believe them. See, at first he did not. His first response was not to believe them. Now you'd think that to the contrary. He'd want to believe them. But that itself indicates that there was a certain protectiveness. That he didn't want to go back to that. Because then you're opening yourself up and maybe it's not true, maybe this, maybe that, maybe who knows what's going on over here. And they had to, they had to prove. They showed them the wagons. Rashi says that that he communicated that was the last thing they'd studied together. Egla Arufa. But even with, in other words, Yosef knew that it would not be so simple to come back with a story like that. And Yosef obviously had to communicate things. I think that's what Rashi is really getting at. That he communicated things to the brothers to tell the father that only Yosef would have done. Things that were personal, maybe things they'd studied, maybe ideas, maybe questions that he had come up with, maybe chidushim and so on and so forth. And then he was forced. So can you imagine? He was forced to accept the fact. Then it says, Vatechi Ruach Yaakov Aviyam, that the spirit of Yaakov came back to life. So in a certain sense, he was dead. I mean, Rashi says he didn't have any prophecy. He didn't have the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit. Because that's the effect, all these years later, that's the effect that what he thought was the death of Yosef had upon him. So that was the tokacha. It was an unintended tokacha. Tokacha doesn't have to be intended. It was an unintended rebuke. And as I think Esti hit on it, and that is, the brothers never fully recognized what they had done to Yaakov. And it is, and when you read the story, it does strike you that they're callous. Because they took the garment, and they dipped it in blood, and they sent it forward with the message, you know, this is the garment of your son, identify it. Identify it. It seems that they're extremely cold. And it seems that they don't realize, you know, they all got up to comfort him, and you're like, he's going to be comforted. It seems that that part of the piece, that piece of the puzzle, they never fully grasped. They were focused completely on Yosef, but they didn't fully grasp the crime they were committing against Yaakov. That they never grasped, and one can understand that, because when you are the victim of what you regard as somebody else's unjustified emotional preference, so then you're not going to have much sympathy. If someone has a favorite which bothers you, you're not, and it really is painful to you, and then something happens to that person, you're not going to have too much sympathy. You're just not going to have that much sympathy. It's like if you were rejected by someone in another day, obviously. You're all married now. But I mean, like, when you were younger and you were, like, crazy in love with someone and this person chose somebody else over you. Okay. And then, all right, so, you know, you move on, whatever the case may be. But you can't forgive that person, even though they didn't do a sin. But there's something wrong with that person. How could they possibly choose that, you know, that girl over me? Then if something bad, some accident should happen to that girl, and this guy, you know, it's a blow to him and whatever, you're not going to have that much sympathy. Theoretically you are, but in reality you're not. Emotionally you're not. Because he was wrong and he was crazy and stupid and basically he deserves it. I know you're not going to say that consciously. I'm just expressing how the emotions work. Because we're very, very selfish. People will never be able, that would be totally different if that were not the case, where you had not been rejected by that guy. You know, you had a friendship and whatever, but you never really were in love with him and he with you, and then you found someone else and he found someone else, and then but you liked the person, and then he suffered this thing with his wife, you'd feel tremendous sympathy for him. But because of the jealousy which creates the hatred, and then something bad happens to someone that you are angry at and you hate, so you're not going to have sympathy for them. It's their fault. Had they not been so stupid, they would be with you and this wouldn't have happened to them. That's the way the feelings work. So they never took into consideration the effect this would have on Yaakov, because they couldn't accept the fact that Yosef was so dear to him. They couldn't face up to that. Had they faced up to that, they would have they would have included that in their calculus. And then they may not have been able to do this because of the tremendous harm they're going to bring upon their father. That's what Yosef rebuked them. That's what Rabbi Chaya said. That was the rebuke. But it was not a conscious or intended rebuke. It was simply an expression of the reality, but the reality itself constitutes the rebuke. And that's what he meant. He cried because, you know, they did this not fully cognizant. So how much more so when God knows everything we've done. We've repressed. We just simply repress and make excuses for 90% of anything we do that's wrong. And we excuse ourselves. And we believe God will excuse us. Yeah, but it's not reality. That's our imagination. But when the actuality, when we're confronted with the actuality of our deeds and its effects, the real rebuke, how much more so? That's the statement of Rabbi Elazar. And that explains it. That is to say, again, the question was not, is he physically alive? But is he still alive in the sense that he's still my father? Because it's quite possible that there'll never be a relationship again. Because in order to survive what happened, he had to just uproot everything from his mind, and it's impossible to go back. That's the way, essentially, that's the way Rabbi Chaya explained it.